So our talk today is a continuation in our discipleship series, Life to the Full, that we have been working through at the start of this new academic year. And our heart is that through this series, we would all be able to dig deeper into what and who is forming us, and how we can allow Jesus in and learn to be formed by and to look more like him. The question is not whether we are being formed, but who and what is forming us, and therefore who we are becoming. We want to take this time to pause and evaluate what we are allowing in so that we can be more intentional about what our lives reflect and ultimately who our lives reflect. Last week, Joel talked about being loved by the God who created us, who formed us from dust and planted his life breath into us. We talked about what forms us, our environment, our relationships, our habits, and how we can actively look to Jesus to allow him to be the potter that shapes us with his hands. This week, we are going to be talking about being loved by a God who sees us, loved by God seen. In a world where being seen, being noticed, our outward appearance, being known, has such high value, what does it mean to be seen by God? So for my day job, when I'm not hanging out with you lovely lot, I design menswear for a fashion label called COS. So I guess you could say that I spend a lot of time thinking about what it means to be seen and the importance of image and how we present ourselves to the world. I work with a lot of incredibly beautiful people. COS is owned by H&M, which is a Swedish company, and so I would say that at least 40% of the people in my office are Scandinavian. Tall, blonde, chiseled jawlines, wearing effortless minimal black shift dresses. It's a lot to live up to when your aesthetic is more farmyard chic. So this is all natural, but I also get to travel a bit to destinations where we have clothes factories, but also where they do really good, really cheap plastic surgery and hair transplants. So I was in one of these destinations a few weeks ago, and I was walking down the main street with one of my colleagues, who I'm pretty sure has a full head of hair, but chooses to have like a number one buzz cut all over. And we were having a laugh, joking about how maybe he could extend his trip a few days and get a hair transplant while we were there. And out of nowhere, this guy just sidles up to us in the street and hands him a business card with some, I've got to be honest, pretty dodgy pics of hair transplants. Like, seriously? I just want to know who's receiving these business cards and being like, I was on my way to dinner with my friends, but now you mention it, maybe I'll just come and get a quick hair transplant with you. In my head, that's not a split-second decision, but clearly someone's making money out of it. And then if you get a midweek term time flight back, it's a bit like being on a plane full of zombies. Like, quite surreal, really. Everyone is bandaged up with little dribbles of blood down their foreheads or from the plaster across their nose. It's a little bit apocalyptic, I'm not going to lie. Don't get me wrong, I'm not here to plastic surgery shame. People get work done for so many different, very valid reasons. I guess what I'm saying is, I know what it feels like to be in an environment where everyone is striving for physical perfection. I know what it is to question if I would be taken more seriously if I wore makeup more often. To think, would I have got that promotion if I dressed a bit better? To be surrounded by people who don't seem to be aging at quite the same rate I am. Anyway, now I've given you the inside scoop on where to go to get your work done. We're going to crack on and read the passage for today, in which we also see people putting a great deal of emphasis on outward appearance. And God maybe not looking at us in quite the same way. So if you have a Bible, please turn with me now to Samuel 16, 1 to 13. And if not, it will appear on the screens behind me. Samuel anoints David. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, since I have rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king." But Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears about this, he will kill me." The Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' Invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what to do. You are to anoint for me the one who I indicate." Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. They asked, "Do you come in peace?" Samuel replied, "Yes, in peace. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, "The Lord has not chosen this one either." Jesse then had Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, "Nor has the Lord chosen this one." Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." So he asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" "There is still the youngest," Jesse answered. "He's tending the sheep." Samuel said, "Send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives." So he sent for him and had him brought in. He was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, "Rise and anoint him. This is the one." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. Samuel then went to Ramah. So let's kick off with a little bit of context. The book of Samuel is one of the books in the Old Testament of the Bible. That's pre-Jesus. So the people of Israel, God's chosen people, have been rescued from slavery in Egypt. Moses has led them for 40 years wandering in the desert, during which time God has provided for their physical needs with manna, as well as their spiritual needs. And they've made a covenant with him at Mount Sinai to remain faithful, and he has given them the Ten Commandments to help them do this. Then they enter the Promised Land, their own land where they can settle and grow in number and be faithful to God. Before the book of Samuel, the book of Judges shows that Israel failed miserably at this task. That's a tongue twister. It was total immoral chaos, and they were in desperate need of wise, faithful leaders. Now, Samuel is a prophet around this time. He's there to hear from God and to speak God's words to the people of Israel and to help them turn back towards him. Anyway, the people of Israel come to Samuel and are like, "Hey, Samuel, we need a king. Everybody else has a king. All these super powerful nations around us, they've got kings, and we are missing out. We want one too." And in despair, Samuel goes to God and is like, "Oh God, the people of Israel, they want a king. Terrible idea. You, God, are the only king. What should I do?" And God's like, "Yeah, their hearts are in totally the wrong place. But if a king is what they want, then give them one." Enter Saul. Saul is appointed by Samuel as king over Israel, and it starts off really well. Saul is tall, he's good looking, he's the perfect candidate for kingship. But he has deep character flaws. He's dishonest, he lacks integrity, and he's extremely proud. And so whilst from his outward appearance you might think that he was the perfect king, he ends up, through his own pride, turning his back on God and disobeying his commands. And so Samuel confronts Saul. He has told the people of Israel that they will only benefit from a king who is going to be humble and faithful to God. And so he goes and tells Saul that God's going to raise up a new king. As you can imagine, this doesn't go down too well, and Saul's downfall begins. And so this is where we find ourselves. Samuel is on his way to appoint a new king of Israel, and God sends him to the house of Jesse and tells Samuel that he's going to appoint one of Jesse's sons as king. Now, at this point, I'm not sure that Samuel has learned from his previous mistakes, because as we can see in our passage, he walks into Jesse's house and he spots Eliab, Jesse's oldest son, and is like, obviously this is the right guy for the job. He's the firstborn, so in ancient Jewish culture, he would have been the one expected to inherit. He's tall and well-built and handsome, just like Saul. But this isn't what God is after. And he rebukes Samuel, saying, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." The Lord looks at the heart and his choice of David, who his family hasn't even bothered to present before Samuel because he was the youngest, least worthy of all the sons. God's choice is not based on his family status or his outward appearance, but simply on his radical and humble trust in the God of Israel. God takes the least likely son, the one who is essentially being treated as a servant, and he elevates him because he sees his heart, not his appearance. And at the end of the chapter, Samuel has anointed him with oil and appointed him to become the new king of Israel. I think that as a society, as people who have grown up around technology and advertising and celebrities, projecting curated, perfect images of ourselves to those around us through our social media pages, we too can be prone to do a Samuel. We can be prone to measuring someone's ability or success on their outward appearance instead of looking at the heart. And it's bad enough doing that to other people, but we also do it to ourselves. There is a dangerous narrative that says your worth and your value are based on how others perceive you, based on the identity that you project to the world. Attention economics has fed us this idea that our worth is wrapped up in other people's perception of us. In our consumer-driven world, one of the most valuable commodities there is our attention. Companies all over the world spend millions of dollars trying to capture it. They are targeting our attention to make money. Companies like Google and Facebook make their millions by harvesting our data so that they can target us with ads that are more likely to hold our attention and encourage us to keep scrolling. The longer they can hold our attention for, the more money they make. And so we are taught that the longer we can hold other people's attention, the more value we have. The average attention span is now just 8 seconds long, down from 12 seconds in 2000, which means that at 9 seconds, your average goldfish now has an attention span longer than your average consumer. And so holding others of people's attention in a digital space becomes this impossible task where we churn out louder, bubblier, funnier, prettier versions of ourselves in order to be seen, to be noticed, and to feel valued. We live in this constant struggle between the idea that we need to self-define to be true to ourselves and the reality that we all need some kind of external validation. Alan Noble, in his book, You Are Not Your Own, says it really well, like this. Even when we discover our true self or create our own identity, we still need some kind of external validation. And so we must express ourselves, a process called expressive individualism. We are our own and we belong to ourselves, but identity always requires the acknowledgement of other people. There's a tension here, and you can find it all over our culture. On the one hand, there is the pull of autonomy. I am my own. Only I can define myself. It doesn't matter how other people see me, only how I see myself. But on the other hand, there is a pull for recognition that is inherently a part of identity. People must acknowledge me for who I am and see me how I desire to be seen. Expressive individualism means that we are always in control of our identity and how we are seen. You be you. Be true to yourself. Follow your heart. Find yourself. That sounds like an awful lot of work to me. Finding myself. I can barely tell you where I am on a map most days, let alone express who Ellen Udall really is. By placing the responsibility to self-define upon ourselves, we've created a generation who feel like it is their responsibility to find and create meaning, purpose, and direction. It is left up to us to create our own moral measuring rod so that we can be sure that we are living a good life. And when we don't live up to these standards we have created for ourselves, we feel shame and guilt that we're morally inadequate. It is such a relief to know that I have Jesus. Because of Jesus, I don't have to strive to create my own identity. He saw me in my mother's womb. He created me. And he loves me unreservedly, without condition or expectation or criteria. Because of Jesus, when I fall short, when I make mistakes, and when I don't measure up, I don't have to worry. I don't have to feel guilty because he has forgiven me. He died on the cross to pay the price for all the mistakes that I am going to make so that I don't have to pay that price, so that I can have unlimited free access to God the Father. Like David, Jesus was not what the world was expecting from a Messiah. He was not the strong warrior king leading his people into battle. He did not win wars. He did not defeat the Romans. Jesus was a carpenter, born to a virgin in a stable, the lowest of the low. Isaiah 53 says this about him. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him with low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. Jesus sees you. Jesus, the unexpected Messiah, whose outward appearance did not amount to much, sees you. He sees the vulnerable and the lowly, and he brings them in. Jesus saw the woman who was bleeding, who was a social outcast, and who only had the courage to touch the corner of his cloak. Jesus saw the woman at the well who was not allowed to draw water at the same time as the other women of the village because she'd led a promiscuous life. Jesus saw the little children whom the disciples were about to turn away because they didn't consider them important enough to be in his presence. Jesus saw them, and he sees you, and he sees me. We do not need to strive for acceptance, for likes, for other people's attention, because we have the full and unreserved attention of our Creator, and he absolutely delights in us. And so as we leave this building this evening, let us go in the knowledge that we are seen and loved by the Father. In the reassurance that our striving for acceptance is fully met, and our guilt from when we fall short is wiped clean through the forgiveness we receive from a God who knows everything there is to know about us. He knows the number of hairs on your head, the number of breaths you take each day. He knows what you had for breakfast this morning and the exact hour you fell asleep to last night. He knows you and he loves you. And who better to be loved by and accepted than the Creator of the heavens? The God that flung stars into space, who divided the land from the sea, who has seen the depths of the ocean and the furthest corners of space. That God, he has seen you. You no longer need to strive to be seen. You do not go unnoticed. You do not need to be more beautiful or stronger or more intelligent or have more hair. He sees you and he loves you exactly as you are. Will the band like to come up? And so tonight, I pray that you, being rooted and established in this love, might have power, together with all the Lord's holy people, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. And to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Amen.